We're looking at the Song of Songs, one of the most intriguing and interesting and different among the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. We've taken a look at Job, which certainly wrestles with the problem that we all face at one time or another. How do we deal with or respond to the challenges or the sufferings that we face in life? We looked at Psalms, which state for us so many of those wishes of our hearts and our relationship with God, those laments, as well as those notes of praise, those songs of confidence. We've looked at Proverbs and begun to understand what it means to be committed to a relationship with God and how it changes one's life in terms of life activities. And we've looked at Ecclesiastes, which probes that tough question about what is the true meaning of life among the various worldviews possible. But now we've been looking at the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon. And I suggested that there is a plot, or we can understand a plot behind the poetry that we face as we read through the eight chapters. But one must make an interpretive choice. Most often in its history of interpretation, the duet, the love duet, has been the primary idea put forward. That is to say, that this is a statement of love between Solomon and a young woman who's unsullied by the world, and he takes as the powerful one this young woman into his grace and his confidences, and she becomes his honored queen. Similarly to the way in which God took Israel and made Israel the queen of the divine plans and activities. Similarly to the way in the New Testament we think of Jesus marrying the church, his body, his bride. But I suggested that there's a second possible way to interpret the Song of Songs, and that's to see it as a love triangle in which it's not Solomon who's the good guy, but Solomon who's doing the wrong things and actually violating the very essence of what it means to be in a meaningful relationship of love. And so we took a look at a possible understanding of the chapters as a plot by which Solomon has seen this woman, brought her into his harem, her country lover comes to claim her and restore her to their relationship in the countryside. Solomon comes looking for her to repossess her. There's a second attempt to get her out of town. Solomon stymies that, and he continues with his lustful wooing. But in the end, the young woman manages to escape and spurns Solomon and marries her country lover. Now, if that's true, then it fits more with the larger drama of love and marriage that we find throughout the Bible, and may even push back against something which is a terrible crime in every age, including our own, and that's sex trafficking, where particularly young girls before their time are stolen away from families and communities and placed in a system where they are just marketed off as property, as things to be possessed. And it almost seems like a subtle, similar idea is resident in the Song of Songs, where Solomon in his power has the ability to grab a young woman out of her context and before her time for mature love, and to place her in a context where she becomes an object of lust. And if we look at this rather as the love triangle in which she escapes from that, it resonates with things that we have found to be true in our own times and in our own attitudes toward love and lust and life and human trafficking. It's good at this point to think about the whole of the Bible from beginning to end and what it seeks to teach us about ethics and morality. Now, this is not the primary tool or use of Scripture. It's a very important part of our understanding of Scripture. The key and central elements are God's intentional relationship with Israel, and God's intentional relationship with the whole of the world through Jesus and the message that's given there. But along the way, if one is in relationship with God, then it's important to understand that there are certain moral codes or ethical choices one makes related to that relationship. And that's where we find a number of helpful ideas that are scattered throughout the Bible. There are at least four things that help shape our ethical and moral response to God. The first of those being creation itself. If indeed there is a creator and this world was made by God, then however the creator intended for this world to be ought to awaken our senses and draw us in our attention to it. What was the creator's intent for humankind? What was the creator's intent for marriage? What was the creator's intent for male and female relationships? And so we see some of that already in Genesis 1 and 2, where God makes human beings, males and females, and endorses and affirms their loving relationships with one another. Now, although there are many expressions of polygamy throughout the Bible and among some of the greatest folks that we know, Abraham and David and Solomon and many others, one of the things that becomes true of the teachings as we move along is that God's intention was something that transcends polygamy. While polygamy happens within the human arena, God's intentions are the intimacy that develops between one female and one male. Jesus affirms that, talking about a man leaving his family and cleaving to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And Paul writes about that when he writes to the young pastors Timothy and Titus. What are the qualifications for those who give leadership in the church? That they're married to one person. So we have that as a kind of larger norm. And even in the fact that the picture of Jesus in the New Testament is that of the bridegroom to the bride. Not the bridegroom to the many brides, but the bridegroom to the singular bride, even though the bride is herself the collective of the Christian people, the church, still it's a singular relationship. And so some of this is simply the manner in which the Bible portrays from beginning to end how God intended for things to be. And it's reflected in that interpretation of the Song of Songs that I've suggested to you, that Solomon may not be reflecting what God intended for human loving relationships, that he may in fact be working against what the creational norms of God were. A second major theme in the Bible is the idea of the restraint of sin. Obviously, we live in a broken and compromised world. That's not something that needs to be proved. It's something that we experience from day to day. People do bad things. They do wrong things. They say bad things. They find themselves in opposition with and antagonistic toward other people. There are relationships that need reconciliation. There are deeds that are sinful and harmful and need to be restored or forgiven or some restitution being made. This is a world in which perfection simply does not exist. And if that's the case, then at least part of what we read in the Bible is God's intention to, for the duration of this age, restrain sin. Perfection was part of the original plan. And perfection and righteousness is part of the outcome seen at the end of times. But in between, how can sin and its effects be restrained? Evil has infested our world. How can that be restrained and counteracted? And so we find things like the Ten Commandments and the law codes to Israel, which are mostly stated in negative ways. Don't do this. Don't do that. Don't go here. Don't participate in that. You should not do this. And those kinds of things are intended as safeguards, sort of as barriers. If you're going to the top of a large building, a skyscraper in one of our major cities, and you go out on the observation deck, you don't need that railing in front of you. You don't need that plate glass in front of you. But you know that if it wasn't there, there'd be people who would push people over, and there'd be people who would jump from that, and there'd be accidents in which people would trip and fall and go over that. And so there's restraints in place in order to accommodate some of the compromised character of the world in which we live. The restraint of sin is a big part of ethical foundations, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And here again, we have those statements in the Song of Songs, don't awaken love before its time. The idea that there may be things that we choose not to do, even in otherwise seemingly loving relationships, because they are inappropriate to age or circumstances. I remember when our daughter, in the first grade came home and said, "I'm in love with Ian." And I remember how we smiled and thought that that was a good thing. But when our daughter in the first grade said, "I'm going to marry Ian," that was quite another issue. She was old enough to understand that love happens even between females and males, but she was not old enough to participate in the mature responsibilities of a relationship that had ongoing significance. They could smile at one another, they could laugh together, they could talk to one another, they could be with one another, but they were not old enough to be married. And there seems to be something of that behind the Song of Songs, where the chorus keeps saying, "Don't awaken love before it's time." There's this sense of the restraint of sin and nasty fingers wagging in the direction of Solomon as if he is doing what is wrong and inappropriate. A third part of the biblical moral and ethical worldview is the idea of what exactly is God's intent for our lives. Not just how did God create us to live, but what are the values of the one who thought up this world in itself? What drives the heart of God? What is it that God values? Fun, probably. Delight, certainly. There are many things we could say. But how do we know the heart of God? How do we know the mind of God? And here a couple of things come into play. When God speaks of God's values through the prophets and apostles, we begin to understand the heart and the passions and the will of God, and we can begin to respond to them because not merely they're forced upon us or because, well, they're the right things to do, but because we learn to love God and mirror God's own values in our lives. You know what it's like to fall in love. You may choose to do things you hadn't thought about doing before when you find yourself in relationship with another person. That person's heart values and desires become intriguing to you, and you want to know more about them. And so, especially through Jesus, we learn more of the heart and mind of God. And when Jesus talks to us about the meaning of marriage, it seems to be different from what the Song of Songs portrays with regard to Solomon. So it's important for us to understand what it is that the mind of God, the mind of Christ, is all about in terms of values that are prominent and how they may reflect in the choices of our lives. And finally, eschatological hope. Not only do we look toward the beginning of time when God made all things and what his intentions were, what God's plans were, what God's standards for the values of human life were, but also for how does God seek to resolve all things? What goals or plans or expectations is God drawing us toward in the consummation of all things? Paul in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians points to this very strongly. Other first-generation Christians in general, their belief that Jesus would return very soon, and we need to keep our eyes focused on the world that is to come and live appropriate to that. Well, what is it that we want to be found doing if Jesus were coming soon, if the world were ending, if God was resolving all things into its final or eschatological expectations? Certainly we would not want to be abusing people, abusing children. We would not want to be doing things that were harmful to a person's psyche. We would want to be invested in loving relationships. And again, these kinds of things begin to reflect also on our understanding of how then the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon may in fact speak to us as we think about all of what it's saying to us. And for those reasons, I think that it's important to understand the Song of Songs in terms of love triangle rather than a love duet, and that Solomon becomes the indication of what we ought not to do in relationships between the genders, and the Shulamite maid and her country friend express the best of what God intends for us to be.